Both of us live, Father.
I ignored that pious hope.
We have to keep Bebbanburg, I told him. And your son won't be of age until he's much older, so you have to keep the fortress for him.
Or you can, he muttered.
Don't be a fool, I snarled.
I can't live that long.
I touched the hammer again. Bebbanburg has been in our family for almost 300 years, and it should still belong to us when the world ends. I thought of Snorri's prophecy, that the Dane and the Saxon would unite against me, that I would die by the sword, that Bebbanburg would be lost, and my children's children would eat the dung of humility. I pushed that memory away, telling myself that Snorri had deliberately been trying to frighten me with riddles.
"You have to survive this fight," I said harshly.
"You want me to hold back from fighting?" my son asked bitterly. He still felt the keen shame of losing so many men to Skull's ambush, and the need to prove himself all over again.
"Yes," I said harshly. "You hold back. If I die, you must live. If we lose this fight, you have to escape, and you have to live long enough to see your son become the Lord of Bebbanburg."
I have fought many battles. I have stood in shield walls and heard the sound of axes biting willow boards. I have heard men howling, heard them screaming. I have heard the butcher's sound of blades cleaving flesh, the heart-wrenching sound of grown men weeping for their mother's comfort. I have heard the grating breath of the dying and the lament of the living. And in all those fights, I have fought for one thing above all others: to take and to keep Bebbanburg. So my son must live.
Hard were the foemen, hungry their swords, and stout their ramparts, they offered death to any man brave enough. Then stood Sitrigur, bold in strife, and called on the Measurer.
"The Measurer?" I asked the poet.
"The Measurer is the Lord God," he said.
He was an inky-fingered young priest named Father Selwyn, a West Saxon who served Hrothweird, the Archbishop of Jofawick.
"He measures our lives, Lord."
"I thought the Norns did that," I said, and he looked at me blankly. "And besides," I went on, "Sitrigur called on Odin for help."
"It's a poem, Lord," he said weakly.
"Were you there?"
"No, Lord."
"Who told you to write the poem?" I asked.
"The Archbishop, Lord."
Hrothweird, of course, wanted to spread the idea that Sitrigur's baptism had converted a pagan into a Christian. That was not dishonesty, even if it was untrue, but rather Hrothweird's passionate hatred of warfare. Despite the treacherous Scots, he still believed that no two Christian nations would ever go to war with each other, and so wanted to convince the Saxon South, and probably himself too, that Sitrigur led a Christian nation. The Archbishop ordered the poem to be copied by monks and sent south to be read aloud in halls and churches, though I suspect most copies were used to wipe arses or light fires. We lit no fires that night, which we spent in an upland valley close to the river. We put sentries on the higher ground, and deep in that cold night, Finan and I climbed to join one group of men, who crouched in the lee of a boulder and gazed westwards. The low clouds had lifted, and far to the west I could see one star through a rent in the night sky, and beneath it a flicker in the darkness, the dim glitter of firelight on a far-off hilltop.
"That must be the fort," Finan said quietly.
No other lights were visible. No fire burned in a hearth to leak flame-light past a shuttered window. The earth was as dark as it must have been when it was first made between the realms of fire and ice. I shivered. And next day it was our turn to lead the column. We were still following the river, but now the tyne had shrunk to a size that could be easily crossed in places, and so I had to put scouts on both flanks, north as well as south. I sent Edric and Oswy to explore far ahead, trusting their ability to stay hidden. Edric, the older man, had a poacher's ability to slide through country unseen, while Oswy had a natural cunning. He had been my servant once, and before that an orphan making a living by theft in the streets of London. He had been caught trying to steal from my storeroom and brought to me for a whipping, but I had liked him, and he had served me ever since. Those two, the older man and the younger, would disappear into the hills, but closer to us I had two large and very visible bands of men, one on the southern skyline and the other high above the river's northern bank. Both bands numbered 30 men. I called them scouts, but I hoped both were large enough to deal with any attack that might come from Skoll scouts. He must have men searching for us, I thought, but as the morning passed we saw no sign of them. We still made slow progress. I might have scouts on either side, but I feared a sudden attack like that which had severed my son's troops, and so I insisted that the column close up and stay closed up, and that meant we could only move as fast as the slowest person on foot. The river slowed us even more because it was in spate, foaming around dead trees that had been carried downstream and flooding its banks. In one place, where we were forced to ride around a churning flood, I saw Jeremias up to his knees in the rushing water. He had ridden to the head of the column, assuring me that was the best place where his god could warn him of danger, and something had caught his eye in the river. "What are you doing?" I called to him.
"The ram of Abraham, Lord! The ram of Abraham!" he called excitedly, bending to his task.
I had no idea what he meant, nor how the ram of Abraham, whatever that was, had reached the Northumbrian hills, but nor did I want to ask, for fear of a long and complicated answer.
"And where are your angels?" I asked him instead.
"Safe, Lord, safe! Still chased!"
He tugged at the tangled birch that half-blocked the river, and I saw he was struggling to pull something from the gaunt branches. It proved to be a dead sheep, its fleece reduced to a sodden grey bundle, and its body just bones. He managed to wrench free the skull that had a fine pair of curled horns. He held it up triumphantly.
"See, Lord, the heathen will be humbled, they shall be smitten."
"By a dead ram?"
"Oh, thou of little faith!"
He staggered in the fierce rush of water.
"Didn't Skoll's sorcerer have a skull in his hands, Lord, when he visited you?"
"A wolf skull."
"Then we need a skull, a Christian skull. Behold," he held up the ram's skull, "the ram of Abraham."
He was still buffeted by the current's force as he tried to reach the river's edge, so I reached down from the saddle, offered a hand, and helped him and his precious skull up onto the bank.
"Stay out of trouble, Bishop," I said. "Your flock needs you."
"My flock are on their knees, Lord, praying mightily for us."
By late morning I was beginning to fear that we needed those prayers. I had joined the scouts on the crest of the southern hill, and could see a smear of smoke in the west, but no enemy horsemen. The smoke, which seemed to come from a distant valley, betrayed a settlement. But if it was Heber, then why did the smoke come from a valley? And we would surely have seen Skoll's men by now. Had they gone south? Were they even now pushing Seatrigger's men out of their path and advancing on Jorfawick? Then, at midday, we had word at last. Skoll and his army were waiting for us. Edric and Oswy brought the news.
"They're at their fort, Lord,"
Edric said,
"and it's a bastard."
"And we're on the wrong side of it," Oswy added gloomily.
I ignored Oswy's words for the moment. "How many?" I asked Edric. He shrugged.
"Hard to tell, Lord. Most of them are inside the walls. Maybe 200 outside. We couldn't get close. We had to watch the bastards from across the valley.
He explained that the Tyne was joined by a stream a couple of miles ahead. The fort, he said, is across the stream's valley.
And it's steep, Oswy added. Is that why we're on the wrong side?
It'll be hard to attack from the valley this side,
Oswy said.
But to the west there's a hill that overlooks the fort.
That sounded strange. Given a choice, no one would build a fort beneath a hill instead of on the summit. But the Romans were not fools, so if Oswy was right, there had to be a reason. I looked at Edric, who nodded confirmation of Oswy's news.
And it's a good-sized hummock, lords. Get on top of that, and the bastards will have a job to drive us away.
They won't try, Seatrigger said.
He had joined us on the heights as soon as he saw the scouts returning.
We have to defeat them, which means we have to assault the fort.
They won't attack us. They want us to attack them.
The walls? I asked Edric.
Big enough, lords. They're not like Chester or Bebbanburg, but you'll need the ladders.
Like Oswy, he sounded gloomy. There were men outside, you said.
Scouring out ditches, lord.
Odin help us,
Seatrigger said unhappily. I pointed at the distant smear of smoke.
Is that Heber?
Edric shook his head.
That smoke's well to the south of the fort, lord, and closer to us.
Lead smelting? Fenin suggested.
Whatever it is, Seatrigger said, it can wait till we've taken the fort.
He looked at me for agreement, and I nodded.
So let's look at the damn place, he finished.
We took 60 men, half Seatrigger's and half mine, and led by Edric, spurred up into the hills. It seemed strange to be riding across the fells towards an enemy who was making no attempt to stop us. We had scouts ahead of us, but those riders saw nothing threatening. The fort, I thought, even if it was overlooked by a hill, had to be formidable if Skoll was content to let us approach it unchallenged. And the country we rode invited such an ambush because, though the rolling hills were bare, they were cut by steep valleys where streams, dark from the peat bogs, had worn down their beds as they tumbled to the Tyne. It was a hard country, bleak and high, and perhaps the only reason the Romans had built their fort here was to protect the pits where their slaves had dug for lead, and the furnaces where they had smelted the silver from the ore. There had to be a road, I thought. How else could the Romans carry away their ingots? And where, I wondered, had those ingots gone? All the way to distant Rome? And I thought of British lead and British silver being dragged across a whole world, through Francia and whatever countries lay beyond. I had met men who had journeyed to Rome, and they had told me the road was long and hard. It crossed mountains, only to end at a ruined city where wild dogs roamed and where great pillars and towering arches stood amidst the weeds. King Alfred had made the journey twice, both times to meet the Pope, and the king had told me how guards had been hired at the foot of the mountains to protect the travellers from the savages who lived in the high places. But the journey, he had told me, was worth the hardships and the dangers.
The city must have been glorious once,
Alfred had recounted.
A wonder, but it was brought low by sin.
As so often, he had been in a melancholy mood, regretting a fallen world.
We must make a new Rome,
he had said, and I had imagined trying to build a great city from clay, wattles, timber and thatch, but knew, as Alfred himself knew, that the world of glory was gone, and we were sinking into a darkness of smoke, fire, savagery and blood.
Lord!
Edric startled me from my thoughts.
There, lord!
And I looked across the valley to see Heber. At last.
Then did Uhtred, hoary in winters, summon his men, eager for battle slaughter. Their swords keen-edged, their shields bound tight, they prayed to the measurer.
"There's that measurer again," I accused Father Selwyn.
"It's a poem, Lord," he said weakly.
"And tell me," I spoke threateningly, "what does hoary in winters mean?"
"That you're an experienced warrior, Lord," he said promptly.
He had obviously expected the question. "Old, you mean?"
"Experienced, Lord, and your beard—"
His voice faltered. "Go on."
"Your beard is white, Lord,"
he said, blushing, then paused.
"Well, grey, Lord."
Another pause.
"Greyish, Lord,"
he tried.
"In places?"
"And my men," I went on, "were not eager for battle slaughter."
"It's a poem, Lord."
"My men were terrified," I told him. "They were frightened. I'd rather fight through the pits of hell than attack Heber again. It was a ghastly place." It was, too. I first saw Heber from the hill across the southern valley, and seeing it, I cursed the Romans. They had built the fort on a wide spur of land that jutted out from the heights to dominate the Tyne's valley. We were a long way distant, perhaps a mile, but as we climbed the hill I saw more and more of the defences and understood why Skoll had chosen to wait for us rather than carry the war across the hills. The fort, which had stone walls with stubby towers at each corner, was built across the spur's long crest. I reckoned the two longer walls were some 150 paces each, the two shorter maybe 100. Those walls had decayed over the years, but Skoll, or maybe Halfdan the Mad, who had once occupied Heber, had heightened and reinforced the broken places with stout timber barricades. There were buildings roofed with turf inside the fort, and the ruins of smaller buildings just outside. Off to the west, where the long hill rose above the fort, I could see pits where, presumably, lead had been mined. That rising ground to the fort's west was the obvious place from which to attack. The land between that higher ground and the fort was level, meaning attackers would not have to struggle uphill to reach the walls, but the Romans, or perhaps others who came after them, had seen the danger, and in front of the fort's western side there were rows of ditches and banks that wrapped around the northern and southern ramparts. They were the ditches that Edric had watched being deepened. Finan, staring down at the place, made the sign of the cross. "That's a bastard," he said mildly. Seatrigger leaned on his saddle's pommel and just stared as a cloud shadow slid across the distant fort. He sighed, and I knew what he was thinking, that too many men must die in this high place.
"If I were Skoll," he said, "I'd put a shield wall on those ditches."
"He doesn't need to," I said. "He can just let us stumble across the ditches and hurl spears at us."
"I can't see too well from here," Finan said, "but it looks as if the entrance behind the ditches is blocked off."
There were four entrances, one on each of the fort's walls. There were well-worn paths from three of those gates, but outside the fourth gate, which faced the widest stretch of ditches and banks, the grass showed nowhere.
"Maybe we just leave the bastard where he is," Seatrigger said morosely.
"And do what?" I asked.
"He must have farms, his lead mines. Destroy them. Force him to come out and fight for them."
I looked northwards to the valley of the Tyne, and guessed most of Skoll's steadings were in the valley's depths. "And if he refuses to fight?" I asked. Seatrigger did not answer. Skoll wanted us to attack him, which was reason enough not to make an assault on his fortress. Our wisest course was to withdraw, but that gave him a victory he needed, a victory that might attract even more men to his banner of the wolf. and as we retreated he would follow us, eventually forcing us to turn and face him.
"If we go south," Seatrigger suggested, "we could combine with Boulder's men."
None of us said anything. None of us wanted to retreat, but nor did we want to carry our spears against that formidable fortress.
"It will have to be fast," Seatrigger said.
"The journey south?"
Svart spoke for the first time.
"The assault," Seatrigger said. "There'll be precious little water on that hill."
He nodded to the land to the west of the hill.
"And no shelter. We'll have to reach that hill, form the wall, and attack."
"There are horses in the fort," Finan said.
"Why wouldn't there be?"
Seatrigger asked irritably. "We make a shield wall, Lord King, and the bastard could release horsemen onto our flanks." Seatrigger grunted, plainly unhappy at Finan's words, but unable to deny their truth.
"What choice do we have?" he asked.
He was plainly reluctant to abandon an assault. We had marched so long. We had Skoll in front of us, and to retreat was to gamble on finding a friendlier battlefield.
"The Lord of Hosts is with you. You cannot fail,"
a voice called from lower down the slope, and I turned to see Jeremias spurring his horse Beelzebub to join us. Seatrigger, who had less patience than I for the mad bishop, groaned. Jeremias was holding a stout staff on which he had managed to tie the ram's skull that, as he joined us, he pointed towards the fort.
"The far corner, lords," he said. "That is where the heathen can best be smitten."
Seatrigger looked annoyed. Svart was puzzled, but Finan knew that Jeremias had moments of sense.
"The far corner?
Ragnar assaulted from there?"
Jeremias was pointing the ram's skull at the northernmost corner of the fort.
"And by God's grace, we smote Halfdan the Mad."
"How many men did Halfdan lead?" I asked.
"A host, lord, a host,"
Jeremias said. Plainly he did not know. "There's a host and a half down there," I pointed out.
"The Lord of Hosts is with you. How can you lose?"
"Easily," Seatrigger snarled. But I could see he was still reluctant to abandon an attack on the fort. He twisted in his saddle to look at me.
"Ragnar?"
he asked.
"Knew what he was doing," I answered. "He was good."
He turned to stare at the fort again. We could not see the ground beyond the northern corner, because the land there dropped away, which meant it would be an uphill attack from ground we had not yet seen.
"We can't do it tomorrow," Seatrigger said. "We need to scout it first."
He paused, wanting someone to agree with his suggestion, but none of us spoke.
"And if it looks impossible," he finished, "we'll march away."
"And if it's possible?"
Svart asked.
"We attack," Seatrigger said.
Which meant the measurer, or rather the Norns, or perhaps both, would be measuring.
Chapter 11
War cries were loud. Ravens and eagles were eager for corpse meat. The earth trembled. Men let fly their spears, files sharpened, bows were loosed, shields' hard blades struck, bitter was the onslaught.
"Onslaught," I said quietly. Father Selwyn looked at me anxiously.
"Is that the wrong word, lord?" he asked.
I had not realized I had spoken aloud.
"It's the right word," I assured the poet,
"but I don't remember any eagles."
"Could there have been eagles, lord?"
"In those hills? I suppose so, yes. Their sorcerer called it the Fortress of the Eagles, so I suppose there must have been eagles."
I paused, then added, "And of course, there was Berg's banner."
Berg's Banner, Lord.
You didn't hear about that?
No, Lord.
It showed an eagle, I said, smiling, then fell silent.
Lord?
The young priest prompted me.
It doesn't matter, I said.
Think about eyes and lips instead.
Eyes and what, Lord?
He thought he'd misheard me.
Eyes and lips, I repeated. They're the first things the ravens eat.
Eagles, too, probably. They perch on the helmet rim and begin with the eyeballs, then tear off the lips. After that, they rip up the cheeks. Have you ever eaten cod cheeks?
Cod cheeks?
They're delicious. Fishermen usually toss the cod heads, but when I was a boy, we used to scoop out the cheek meat. Ravens seem to like the taste of our cheeks, unless, of course, you've laid the man's skull open with an axe. Then they feast on the brains first. Father Selwyn had a boyish face and fair hair that fell across his eyes. He frowned.
I'm not sure I can put those things in a poem, Lord, he said faintly.
And after the ravens, I went on, the dogs come. Dogs, foxes and wolves. They like corpse meat too, but they start feeding lower down the corpse, usually.
So, really, Lord,
Father Selwyn dared interrupt me,
the word onslaught can stay.
It's the right word, I said again, and bitter is right too. War is bitter. The poets give battle a splendour, extolling the brave and exulting in victory, and bravery is worth their praise. Victory too, I suppose, but the poems, chanted in mead halls at night, give boys and young men their ambition to be warriors.
Reputation.
It is the one thing that outlives us. Men die, women die, all die, but reputation lives on like the echo of a song. And men crave reputation, as they crave the heavy armourings that mark a warrior's victories. We revel in reputation, and I am as guilty as the next man. Proud that when men speak of me, they tell how I slew Ubber Lothbroxen, cut down Svein of the White Horse, killed Knut Longsword, and defeated Ragnar the Sea King. But reputation does not remember the ravens tearing a man's face, the weeping of men dying, or the weariness of victory. There is almost nothing harder than leading men to battle, knowing that some will die. That young men we have trained to fight and come to love as comrades will whimper like infants.
It is better to talk,
Hrothweird, the Archbishop, often told me,
than to kill.
But how does one talk to a man like Skoll, who craved reputation and claimed a kingdom and was willing that any number of young men should die to sate his appetite? I remember the ravens. They kept us company next day as we struggled to reach the place from where we could launch our onslaught. The ravens were big and glossy black, raucous and hungry, and they seemed to know what feasts we were preparing. And those preparations took all day as we left the Tyne Valley and crossed a high saddle of the hills to the south-east of Heber. Once across the saddle, we dropped to another valley, where a stream ran fast. Skoll must have watched us, but such was the skill of his scouts that we saw none of them, though once in a while a raven would fly from a boulder, and I suspected the bird had been disturbed. But when my own scouts climbed the heights, they saw no one. Perhaps Skoll sent no scouts. He must have guessed we would attack from the high ground to the west and were hiding in the valley beyond. We would stay in the valley through the night, and our horses would stay there when we attacked at dawn. Sigtryggr sent 20 men down to the Tyne with orders to light fires once night fell. I doubted Skoll would be fooled by the glow in the darkness into thinking we were camped there, but Sigtryggr wanted to put a small nagging doubt into his mind. I had 1,000 nagging doubts. At dusk, just as the rain started. Seatrigger, Finan, Seatrick, Svart, and I climbed to the hilltop with a dozen men to protect us. We lay on the coarse, damp grass and stared down at the fort. The southern corner, with its low tower, faced us, and in front of the western wall I counted 7 banked ditches.
"He'll expect us to attack there," Seatrigger said. "Across the ditches, it's the easiest approach."
"Which is why there are ditches," I said.
"And your mad bishop thinks we should assault the northern corner."
"So do I," I said. From our new vantage point, I could see there was a ditch at that far corner, but it looked shallow. And beyond the ditch was a rough patch of land before the ground fell sharply away to a stream. There was a tower at that northern corner. I supposed it had once been made of stone, but now was a timber platform with a wall around its summit. A flag hung limp and damp from a pole on the tower.
"We should do what he expects," Seatrigger said, "and attack from the hill. And maybe that will pull men away from the northern corner. Then we make a surprise assault from the north."
I was not sure how we were to spring that surprise. The defenders on the wall and the corner tower would be above us and could watch our movements.
"That might work," I said dubiously, "but he has plenty of men."
I could see my comment had annoyed Seatrigger. He wanted to attack and was in no mood to hear of difficulties. He knew them anyway, and the persistent rain that was being blown by an east wind and was hard enough to obscure our view of the fort only added a new problem.
"The bowstrings will be sloppy," I added. "Bugger the bowstrings," Seatrigger snarled, but he knew I was right.
In rain, the bowstrings became slack. I had brought the archers to harass the men on the ramparts, and wet bowstrings would make the arrow strikes feeble. Even a dry and taut cord would not give a hunting arrow enough force to pierce a shield, and it was a rare strike that drove through mail. But a hail of arrows forced men to keep their faces down beneath their shield rims.
"So what do we do, Lord?" Svart asked.
"Dawn tomorrow,"
Seatrigger sounded anything but enthusiastic.
"We'll attack across the ditches."
He had stressed the "we," meaning that his own household warriors would make that attack.
"But we don't push it too hard. We're trying to make them think that's our main assault. You,"
he had edged back from the skyline and was looking at Seatrick, who had brought 62 warriors from Dunholm,
"you'll be on our right. You and your men are there to stop them outflanking us with horsemen. And you, father-in-law," he looked at me, "will be on the left, doing the same thing. Stopping horsemen. And slowly getting closer to the northern corner."
He paused, as if expecting me to say something, but I just nodded.
"And when you think the moment's right," he went on,
"we attack." I finished the phrase for him.
"You attack the northern corner."
He sounded anything but confident, and I knew he was tempted to withdraw, to leave Skoll in his fortress and march south in hope of finding a better place to fight.
"Damn the rain," he said, as he slid back from the skyline.
The rain not only enfeebled bowstrings, it made sword hilts slippery. It made shields heavier. It seeped beneath our mail so we were chilled and the leather liners chafed. It was the same for the enemy, of course, but that night our enemy was in shelter, with fires, listening to the rain pelt on the roof. They slept while we suffered and prayed.
"Prayed, Lord?"
the poet priest asked me eagerly.
"We were horribly vulnerable there," I explained. "We were in a deep valley, and Skoll could have led his men out and attacked us from the heights. He didn't. He left us alone."
I paused, remembering.
"It was a risk, but the Norse don't like fighting at night. They never have." "But you prayed,"
Father Selwyn insisted. I saw what he was suggesting. Of course we prayed, I said. But to Freyr, not to your god.
Ah,
he reddened.
Freyr?
He's the god of weather, I explained. The son of Njörður, the sea god. Doesn't your religion have a god of weather?
There is only the one god, Lord.
He was too nervous to say I was teasing him.
One god, Lord, to govern everything.
No wonder it rained so much. But Freyr answered our prayers.
He did, Lord.
The rain stopped overnight, and the wind went into the south.
South, Lord?
He understood that the rain ending was good news, but could not see the significance of the wind backing. What happens when a warmer wind blows over wet land? I asked. He gazed at me for a heartbeat.
Fog, Lord?
Fog. The dawn brought a dense fog that shrouded the hills, and it was in that fog that men hefted the shields that had served as pillows, loosened swords in damp scabbards, drank ale and stamped warmth into wet feet. We marched before sunrise, or at least we moved away from the place we had spent the night, filing up and around the hill, seeing nothing that was further than 20 or 30 paces away. We startled a deer that bounded away down the slope, and I tried to find an omen in that sudden flight. Fog, thicker than any smoke in the hall, wrapped about us, and we hoped it deadened the sounds we made, because, though we had ordered our troops to be silent, the grey light was filled with scabbards banging on shields, footfalls, the curses of men tripping, and the tearing of grass and heather. Yet the gods loved us that morning, because somehow we did not get lost on the hill. Edric, with his poacher's skill, led us, but it took time, so much time, to make the short journey uphill. At first we followed the remnants of a Roman road, but as we neared the fort we turned left, making for the gentler slope above Skoll's ramparts. I had hoped, like Sea Trigger, to make the assault in the half-darkness, but the sun was glowing through the eastern fog by the time we were in place. Shapes shifted in the fog. The fog itself drifted, and I had a glimpse of a wall and of spearmen lining the rampart. Our silence had been wasted, because the enemy was awake and ready for us. They would have woken anyway as Sea Trigger and Svart began shouting at their men to make a shield wall, and the enemy, hearing the orders, began to bellow insults. An arrow flew from the fortress to bury itself in the turf, well short of any man. Bebbanburg! I shouted, not as a challenge but to rally my men. Finan and my son echoed the chant, and slowly my warriors appeared from the fog.
Shield wall! Finan bellowed. Here!
He was standing to the left of Sea Trigger's men, who were still making their own wall as stragglers came from the wind-stirred fog.
Move! Move! Move!
My son was yelling. Some of Sea Trigger's warriors joined my men by mistake, and there was confusion as they left to find their own ranks. The fog was thinning. I had climbed a small hummock to see over the shambles of our half-formed shield wall, and could see helmeted men watching us from Heber's wall. They were watching and jeering, telling us we were all doomed men. Rorik brought my standard.
"Plant it here, boy," I told him. "And—"
"Stay out of the fight, Lord,"
he interrupted me. "Stay out of the fight," I said, helping him thrust the banner's staff into the hummock's turf. "And if it all goes wrong," I added, "you run like the wind." Why did I tell him that? I think even at that moment, as the fog thickened again, and as Skoll's men jeered us, I knew we had made the wrong choice. We should have fought Skoll anywhere except at this high place, where he had wanted us to fight him.
"End of the wall! Here! Here!"
That was Berg. Somehow he had managed to bring his precious eagle flag, as well as a shield and a spear, and he rammed the flag's staff into the turf to mark the northernmost end of our shield wall.
"Line up on me!" he shouted. "Here!"
He spread his banner to make himself more visible.
"Here!"
He was facing us, and a sudden shift in the fog revealed Skull's men beyond him. Beyond him and near to him. Much too near. Men who had left the fort to attack us before our shield wall was formed, grey-helmeted men with snarling wolves on their shields, warriors who came howling from the grey fog. And Berg had not even drawn his sword.
Then was the clashing of shields. The sea-wolves came, furious to the fight. The spear often pierced the lifehouse of the doomed. They stood fast, warriors in combat, warriors falling, weary with wounds. The dead fell on the earth.
I read Father Selwyn's lines and flinched as I remembered that sudden attack from the morning fog. "I suppose we did stand fast," I told the poet. "Eventually."
"Eventually, Lord?"
"They surprised us," I said. "In that fog we were supposed to surprise them, but they surprised us. We weren't ready. What saved us was that Skull didn't send enough men. I don't think there were more than 60. He should have sent 200.
"And they were... what is the word, Lord? Ulf...
Ulfhjevnar," I said. "But no, these men weren't crazed. But you're right, they came furious to the fight." Skull's men might not have been crazed by Henbane, but they still came like wolves, howling. They came to kill. And in that first moment I lost 8 men. I blame myself. If you lead men and women, then your success is their success. But the failures are all yours. All mine. I remember the leaping enemy, mouths open, shields held to one side so they could stab with spear or sword. Serdic, big and loyal but always slow, was the first of my men to die. He had been going to join Berg, and I saw him turn in surprise. He did not even have time to resist, and a Norseman's spear went clear through his body. So hard was that opening thrust. I saw the mail at Serdic's back bulge, then the spearhead tore through, and a second Norseman slashed his sword across Serdic's face, and the blood was bright in that grey morning. The enemy was yelling, triumphant. Wolfmeyer, another Saxon, was behind Serdic. He had been one of my cousin's warriors, who had sworn his loyalty to me, and I watched him die. He had time to raise his spear, level it, even begin to charge against the mass of men hurling themselves towards us, but he was jarred back by a spear thrust to his shield. He half turned, lunged his own weapon, and a Norseman's sword knocked it aside, and another man drove an axe down through Wolfmeyer's helmet and split his skull like a log. I ran forward, serpent breath drawn, then Finan slammed into me from my right, stopping me.
"To me! To me!" he shouted.
The gods only know how fast he must have moved, because only a moment before he had been yards away from me.
"To me! Shields!"
He knocked his shield against me.
"Raise it!"
he snarled at me. I confess I was in a daze, appalled by the sudden onslaught. Someone, it turned out to be Beanoth, stood to my left. Skull's Norsemen were 20 paces away. Berg had vanished. Kettle, another of my Norsemen, had been following Wolfmeyer, probably teasing him. Now he whirled, sword drawn, and bellowed defiance. A Norseman charged him, spear levelled, Kettle danced clear, slashed once, and the enemy reeled away, blood streaming from his face.
"Come back!"
Finan shouted, and Kettle tried. But 2 men trapped him, drove him a pace backwards, Kettle lunged forward. His sword pierced a man's belly and was trapped there, and I shouted in futile anger as another warrior's sword ripped across Kettle's throat. Kettle had been a fine swordsman. A man who loved embroidered clothes. A vain man. But one whose jests could fill a hall with laughter. More men were joining our shield wall. I could hear the clatter of willow boards touching as we made the wall, but ahead of us men were still dying. Godric, who had been my servant, was pinned to the earth by a spear through the belly. He screamed like a child. Edwald, surly and slow, tried to run and was tripped by a spear. He screamed too. Thurston, a devout Christian who would earnestly tell me my soul was in danger, killed a Norseman with a massive spear thrust and was still thrusting and shouting as two swords sent his soul to heaven. He had a wife in Bebbanburg and a son in Jofurwick who was studying to become a priest. Then Kenwulf, a reliable man, honest and patient, had his belly opened by an axe. He moaned as he fell, trying desperately to cling to his sword as his guts spilled and he collapsed onto the blood-soaked turf. He was a Christian too, but like so many others, he wanted to die with his weapon in his hand. The poet-priest was right. Well fjoll on Jothan, the dead fell on the earth. All that happened in a moment. The dead men had been going to join Berg, and were caught by the Norsemen who came streaming across the corner of the ditches. So my warriors died. But their death slowed the attackers for an instant, just long enough for the rest of my men to make the crude shield wall. But what really saved us was Svart, charging in from the right at the head of Sitrigger's men. Then was the clashing of shields. Svart came like an Ulfhjeðin, maddened with battle rage, a huge man, his beard hung with bones, and with a great war axe in both hands. At least a score of men were with him. Their shields clashed against Skoll's shields. It was Norseman fighting Norseman in a fury of blades. Forward! I shouted, and my shield wall went into the fight. There were men beside me, men behind me. Men screaming as much from fear as defiance. But we were a shield wall, as were Svart's men, and Skoll's men had attacked in a frenzy which left them scattered. Their battle rage was singing in their heads. They were slaughtering. They could not be beaten, except by a shield wall. And we struck them hard. Spears lunged. Svart had killed two men before my shield wall hit the Norsemen, but we added two more dead. Both pierced by spears, and I saw a black-bearded man bellowing at Skoll's men to make a wall. More of my men were coming, more of Sea-Triggers were joining Svart. Bionoth, beside me, rammed his spear at the black-bearded man, who fended it off with his shield. I saw a new scar of wood slash across the snarling wolf daubed on the man's shield. He lunged with his own spear, aiming at Bionoth, who, in turn, caught the blade on his shield, and I stepped forward and rammed serpent breath at the big beard and felt her point cut into his throat. He half fell backwards, held up by the men behind, and Finnan cut at the man next to him, slicing Soul Stealer into his mail-clad shoulder. A hammering of shields to my left, and I saw my son had extended our wall and was leading new men into the fight, and then we could go no further. The Norse had made their wall, our heavy shields crashed together, and we heaved against each other. Serpent Breath was the wrong weapon for this fight. Her blade was too long for the deadly embrace of shield walls. I dropped her and drew Wasp Sting, my short sea axe, and slid her between my shield and Finnan's. She struck wood. I pushed on my enemy's shield. Above the iron rim my enemy had fair hair. A dirty, puck-scarred face, gritted teeth, a slit up the side of one nostril, and a short beard. He was young enough to be my son. He was shouting his hatred at me. A spear came from behind me, over my shoulder, and sliced open his cheek.
Blood started fast. His shield faltered, and I skewered Wasp Sting again, this time feeling her strike and pierce mail. The hatred on the young man's face turned to surprise, then fear. Something struck my helmet, and for a heartbeat I was dazed. I did not see the blow, nor knew whether it was a spear or a sword that gave it. But the blow forced me back, and Wasp Sting slid free. I pushed forward again, shield high, and kept pushing, kept stabbing. Svart, disdaining to use a shield, was roaring to my right, swinging his massive axe to drive Skull's men back. The young man opposite me was shouting again, every bellow bubbling blood from his sliced cheek. Our shields grated together, and I spat a challenge as I felt Wasp Sting bite again. And this time she sank deep into the flesh beneath the mail, and I twisted her, tried to rip her upwards, and felt an enemy's sword pushing at my waist. Then that pressure suddenly vanished. A horn had sounded from the ramparts, and it must have been some kind of signal because the men opposing us went backwards, then turned and ran back along the ditches towards one of the fort's three remaining entrances. The fourth, which faced Sea Trigger's men across the western ditches, had been blocked with thick timbers. The fog was almost gone, leaving slow tendrils that writhed above the bloody turf. Heavy spears were thrown from the ramparts, and one hammered into my shield, weighing it down. I stepped away from the men hurling the spears, and wrenched the blade free from the willow board. I picked up Serpent Breath. Neither my men nor Svart's had followed the retreating Norsemen. I saw that the young man with the wounded cheek had gone with them, but he was limping and staggering. I wiped Wasp Sting on the hem of my cloak and looked at Finnan.
"I'm sorry."
"Sorry, Lord?"
"I was slow. You weren't, I'm sorry."
"They were quick, Lord. They were quick."
"Maybe Skold's right. I'm getting old."
The Norse in the fort were jeering us.
"Welcome to Skullholm," they shouted.
I looked at our dead.
"Did Wolfmere have children?" I asked, and should have known the answer.
"Two," Finnan said. "The oldest was that little red-headed bastard who pushed his sister into the cesspit."
"You're bleeding."
He looked at his shield arm. One of his arm rings was almost severed. The mail sleeve beneath was ripped, and blood was seeping through a rent in the leather liner.
"I think I killed the bugger who did that."
He flexed his fingers.
"No real damage, Lord."
It is strange how there is sometimes a sudden calm in a battle. Not that it was quiet, because Skull's men were still shouting and banging sword blades against their shields. But for a moment, neither side was trying to kill the other. We had made a long shield wall that straddled Heber's high spur, but were making no attempt to advance, while the enemy was content to wait behind their ramparts. I counted 7 dead from my men, and 4 from Svart's troop. 7 Norsemen had joined them in death, and Berg was missing. Berg, whom I loved like a son. Berg, so eager to please, and so fearsome in battle. Berg, whom I had saved from death and who had proved so loyal a companion. He had been at the left-hand end of our line when I last saw him, and I walked there to ask if anyone had seen him.
"He went down the hill, Lord,"
Redbad told me. "He escaped?" Redbad, a Frisian, shrugged.
"Lost sight of him, Lord. Bastards were on us."
I walked a few more paces to gaze down into the next valley, where another fast stream tumbled on its stony bed. The valley was empty. Berg and his precious eagle flag were both gone. I supposed Skull's men had taken the banner as a trophy, but had they taken Berg too? My son had the same fear.
"You think he's a prisoner?"
"I hope not," I said, then wished I had not expressed the hope. Better to be a prisoner, I suppose, than dead. But any prisoner of Skull's might expect a foul death. I had seen enemies carve a screaming man to a slow death as a taunt to his watching comrades, and Skull was more than capable of the same cruelty.
Maybe he joined Sea Trigger's men, Lord,
Redbad suggested. He wouldn't do that. He's one of us.
I can look, Lord.
If you want. Though I knew he would not find Berg. If, somehow, the young Norseman had survived the sudden assault from the fog, he would have sought me out. I tucked the hammer at my breast and prayed that he lived. Sigtryggr was shouting at his men, telling them to hoist their shields, to keep the wall straight, to carry their swords and spears to the enemy's ramparts. A score of boys had carried the unwieldy ladders up the hill, and men in Sigtryggr's second rank now hefted the ladders.
"We can win!" Sigtryggr shouted. "We will win!"
He paused to let his men answer the shout, but the response was poor. He called again, assuring them of victory. But the battle's opening had gone Skull's way, and our men were uncertain. None wanted to go forward to where Skull's jeering men were confident behind their wall. Battles rarely begin with a sudden bloodletting. Insults come first. Men stand and watch the enemy. They listen to the taunts of the enemy and the shouts of their leaders, and they summon the courage that is needed before a fight. But this battle had begun abruptly with Skull's assault from the fog, and it had left our troops cold, damp, and dispirited. Had the sorcerer cursed us? In truth, none of us had truly wanted to attack the fort, but Sigtryggr desperately wanted this campaign over. He wanted Skull, who was claiming Northumbria's throne, dead. Perhaps we should have withdrawn, gone south, waited for Skull to follow, and then fought a battle in open land. Instead, we were locked in a deadly embrace with a grim fort, and it was too late to withdraw. If we retreated, we would be pursued by Skull's triumphant and vengeful men, by warriors on horses who would harry us down the hill like a pack of wolves savaging sheep. The poet's priest frowned when I told him that.
"Why didn't you have horses, Lord? I thought the leaders were always mounted in battle."
"Not always."
"But you could have taken your horses."
"It would have been difficult," I said. "The path up from the valley was steep, and there was no space on Heber's spur for a mass of horsemen, but yes, we could. We thought about it, and Sigtryggr and I discussed it the night before. And we decided no horses." Father Selwyn frowned.
"But don't you see better from horseback?"
"We do," I explained patiently, "but we knew it would be a hard fight, maybe a desperate fight. And if we had taken our horses, then our men would think we were ready to flee if the worst happened. By staying on foot, like them, we ran the same risks, and they knew it. That's why."
"So then you attacked the fort?"
"Only after we'd shared the last of the ale. We brought it all to the hilltop. But then, yes, we attacked." Sigtryggr and Svart led that attack. They took their shield wall forward, and the spears began coming as soon as they reached the outer ditch. Very few arrows, I noticed. It was mostly heavy spears that were being hurled from the ramparts. I could hear the blades thumping into shields. Sigtryggr's rearmost ranks were throwing spears back, not really in hope of killing any of the defenders, but trying to force them to shelter behind their shields. Cuthwulf, a hunter from Bebbanburg who led my archers, came to join me.
"Should we be using the bows, Lord?"
He was a sinewy, sun-darkened man, whose limp did not prevent him from being the most deadly of my hunters. "How many arrows do you have?" Cuthwulf spat.
"Not enough, Lord. 50 apiece."
I winced. "Save them." I jerked my head northwards. "You see that far corner?" It looked a long way off. "Use the arrows when we attack there. Not until then." I glanced up and saw a watery sun showing through the lifting fog.
"That'll give your bowstrings time to dry out."
"I kept them under my hat," Cuthwulf said. "So they're dry enough, but God save you, Lord."
My shield wall overlapped the fort, so that we could look north down its long side towards the Tyne Valley.
The lower part of the wall was made of stone, but over the years men had removed the upper courses to build barn or hall foundations, and the upper part was made of